Now, rethinking the Supreme Court. Here's a question. If it were up to you, would Supreme Court justices serve lifetime terms? And would you leave it up to the justices to decide which cases they want to hear? A group of lawyers says no on both counts. A proposal organized by Paul Carrington, a professor at Duke University, says Congress should rethink the way the court works, including a call for a kind of term limits for the justices. More than 30 lawyers, law professors signed on. What about you? Should Supreme Court justices face limits on the amount of time they spend on the bench? Call and tell us why, or why not. 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. You can also get into the conversation at our website, npr.org, and click on Talk of the Nation. Paul Carrington joins us now from a studio at Duke in Durham, North Carolina. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So what is the nature of these limits or term limits that you're proposing?
Well, they're not strictly term limits. There isn't idea that enough's enough of a Supreme Court justice's career, and that particularly as we have improved health care so that people age longer, and as there's been some impulse to appoint people to the Supreme Court at a younger age, the prospect of having people sit on the court for many decades has become a reality. So that I think was the genesis of the movement, and it's not a very movement, maybe too strong a word, but there are a lot of us around who think that Congress ought to think about that problem, among others, that affect the way the Supreme Court operates and affect the way we think about the Supreme Court. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask about that other point about the picking the cases they hear.
Yeah, well, that idea has been is derived from a series of proposals that have been made over the last half century. I was on a committee, worked for a committee some 40 years ago that reported that the federal judicial system didn't work very well because the Supreme Court wasn't doing everything that needed to be done. Mm-hmm. And another report came out a few years later, done by Paul Freund at Harvard and Alex Bickel at Yale, and they came basically to the same sort of conclusions. And then there was a third report done by a Senate committee led by Senator Hruska that came to basically the same conclusion, and nothing was done. Then there was a fourth job done by the Federal Judicial Center that produced no result. And then a few years ago, there was another committee led by Byron White. I will say I'm pretty confident that Byron White would agree with Justice White would agree with all four of those proposals that are set forth in the document that we sent off to the Judiciary Committees and to the Vice President and to the Attorney General.
Well, I should say the other two proposals deal one with justices resigning if they're old or ill or too old or ill to perform, and the other limiting the term of the Chief Justice. But so someone's been there a long time. What's wrong with that?
Well, one thing that's wrong with it, of course, is that they are going to become superannuated, and that sometimes happens. Another problem with it is that they do become a little bit, tend to become a little bit arrogant about their status and about their power and about their responsibility, and maybe a little bit insensitive to the social and political and other considerations that animate other people. We've had some very good justices who were very old, but the problem only becomes a really serious one when you think about the whole court aging together because of the status of health care and the youth that are being the youth of the people who are being appointed. If you're going to appoint people at 40, Clarence Thomas may sit on the court for 50 years, and if you think of the court as being a group of people who are appointed under those circumstances and retained, it becomes a pretty stagnant enterprise. And not only is it stagnant, but as I say, there's a kind of institutional arrogance associated with that we think it would be useful to try to qualify and correct a little bit by giving them some sense that their duties are constrained and are limited.
So, is there any, I'm just wondering, since you mentioned Clarence Thomas nominated by a conservative or at least a Republican president, is there some political agenda here?
No, not really. All of the proposals are clued in a way that does not affect anybody who's presently sitting on the court. We're not trying to change the appointments for President Obama. Nobody has that ambition. But we would like to fix it so that every president, every 2 years, would appoint a Supreme Court justice who would presumably reflect a little bit the social, political, economic aspirations of the present president and Senate of the United States, and that would provide a measure of stability and recall for the institution that would be highly desirable.
But what would you do with the people? I mean, if you're picking a new one every 2 years, do you rotate people off every whatever it is?
Well, the idea as it's proposed is that the nine most recently appointed would be the ones who would normally sit. But there are often cases in which we're shorthanded, and then there's some other duties that Supreme Court justices perform, like making the rules of procedure ruling on some kinds of administrative questions that we'd leave them in the court for that purpose. So they wouldn't. And let me say, a part of the picture here is that ordinarily federal judges do retire after about 20 years, give or take a period of time, because they get to retire at full pay. And federal judges take that offer for the most part.
That seems reasonable.
But Supreme Court justices hardly ever do. O'Connor's the only one who's done it in a good long while.
Interesting.
And they get a lot of power and they don't work very hard. Okay, it's really not a very hard job. The number of cases they are deciding and the amount of staff support they have make it pretty easy. And Supreme Court justices are partly busy writing books. I noticed Justice Scalia was in Florida a few days ago, peddling his latest book that he's written. Which he had plenty of time to do because they're only deciding 70 cases a year.
Wow. Well, let's invite our listeners to come join the conversation.
Sure.
Some of them may want to be authors as well. Anyway, I don't know. Joshua in Roanoke, Virginia, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
My comment was in terms of, an outside body, an independent body deciding what cases the Supreme Court hears, I think that's a welcomed idea. The only thing that scares me in regards to term limits or implementing term limits on Supreme Court justices would be if it were to have an effect where it would almost erode some of the objectivity of judicial review and inject politics into them making their decisions and evaluating cases.
Well, how would that work? Why would term limits make that more likely?
If there were term limits imposed
Joshua, I'm curious how you see term limits making that more likely.
Well, maybe if a justice felt compelled to support the ideals of the body that put them into the position.
Okay. Well, let me ask Paul Carrington what he makes of that.
Well, I don't foresee that happening any more than it already does. Let me say that the judgment that the justices are using in picking the cases they choose are highly political observations. I mean, it's a matter of what kind of cases would you like to write an opinion about, Your Honor? That's the issue that's posed for the justices when they select their cases. I don't know that it would be magnified at all by the fact that there was some rotation in the court. I suppose it is probably true that justices are a little bit loyal to the president who appoints them, but I think we could probably, if we looked for it, find a lot of counterexamples to that. I don't think they're particularly hung up on the president who appointed them.
True.
And in any case, they're not going to be around for very long.
Let's go to another call now, and Mary in Naples, Florida.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I called because I said to myself, this is one of the smartest things I've heard in a long time. I'm a developmental psychologist, and one of the things that you know just out of human nature and the aging process is that the 20-year-old doesn't think like a 30-year-old, the 30-year-old doesn't think like a 40-year-old, the 40-year-old doesn't think like a 50-year-old. And the longer they stay on, the more their views naturally change, and it's difficult. I think we need generational diversity. I think the term limit should be 10 years. That would provide literal generational diversity and experience. Of course, there would have to be a minimum. You know, you wouldn't want a 20-year-old and a... Mm-hmm. I'll start arguments there, but... And I think that the fact that they can choose what they want to write decisions on is... should be based on specialities or background prior to being appointed as a Supreme Court justice, as opposed to, well, you know, what do you think about this thing? You think you do a good job here or whatever? It was absolutely amazing when you learned that process.
Well, Mary, thanks for that point of view. Although I suppose if we did have term limits, 20-year-old wouldn't be such a scary proposition if it was only for 10 years. But you're talking longer than 10 years, aren't you, Paul Carrington?
Well, yeah, the scheme that our group suggested would lead to terms of about 18 years, give or take a little bit, something on that order. That is more congruent with experience elsewhere in the world. Let me say, one of the wonderful things about the Supreme Court is it's unique. The only body that bears a really real resemblance to them in regard to their kind of security and status is the College of Cardinals. There are no courts anywhere where they have something called life tenure. Everybody's got an age limit or a term limit of some sort that constrains the exercise of that kind of power. And I think it makes sense that it would be a fairly long term because you want people to invest their careers in it. You don't want them to be thinking that, I'm going to do this for a little while and then I'm going to sell my services to somebody else, because that would impair their judicial independence, which is a very important feature of the system. We want justices and judges to be not thinking about their own personal ambitions. The great, great, great virtue of the jury system is that juries cannot be bribed or intimidated, and you want judges who can't be bribed or intimidated. And if you had them in for short time, they would be thinking about, what am I going to do next, and who's going to take care of me?
Right. We're talking with Paul Carrington. He's a professor of law at Duke University, about an interesting proposal to change the way the Supreme Court is structured. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we have an email here from Nicholas in Iowa who says, wouldn't this take a constitutional amendment? And couldn't the Supreme Court interpret the amendment? Additionally, wouldn't this create a campaign for the Supreme Court, that is, people lobbying themselves for those positions? What about that?
Well, people do lobby themselves for that position. That's already a reality, Circuit judges are undoubtedly aware of the fact that they are candidates for the Supreme Court and do conduct themselves in ways that make themselves more eligible for consideration for that role. If that were the question, recall the first part of that question, which was. Can you read me the first sentence?
Yeah, sure. I have it here. It says, yeah. Wouldn't this take a constitutional amendment?
Oh, well, yeah. No. Okay, yeah. The short answer to that question is no.
Really?
There's an argument that a constitutional amendment would be needed to impose term limits or some kind of age limit on the court. The Article 3 of the Constitution does say that the justices shall serve for good behavior.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't say anything more than that. That certainly leaves some room for defining, and one certainly could, we think our system of saying, you know, sit for 18 years and then you become a senior judge and we use you when you're available and when we have a case for you to decide and you do some other things around the court is still within the limits of good behavior. Now, there are people who do argue that that provision would require a constitutional amendment, and part of my answer to that is, well, okay, do it. If somebody wants to make a constitutional amendment out of it, it could be done, perhaps, although it would be a very hard sell. One of the problems we face with all four of our proposals is finding a political constituency for it. The Supreme Court of the United States has never been very good about thinking about the judiciary. In fact, I've said on other occasions, the only guy in the history of the U.S. Senate who ever took seriously his responsibility for this set of issues was a guy named Everts, who got the Judiciary Act of 1891 enacted, which created the United States Courts of Appeals. And he said he'd made a major part of his life to try to reduce the kingly power of the United States district judges. It's a hard thing to do, and a constitutional amendment would be hard to do as well. But if Congress wants to pass a constitutional amendment, I wouldn't oppose it. But depending on what it said, if we're talking about an 18 or 20-year term or 75-year-old age limit or something of that sort, it's a reasonable thing to do. The other three proposals we make clearly have no constitutional impediment to them. The Chief Justice of the United States is not appointed for good behavior. He's just designated by the president. Something could be done about providing some kind of rotation in that job, which would make a good deal of sense. The job is a very different job than anybody envisioned that it would be in the 18th or 19th century. We've assigned a whole lot of other duties to the Chief Justice of the United States, and it would make some sense to make that person in some degree accountable to some kind of governmental process for the successes or failures of performance. Likewise, the selection of the cases. For a long time, the Supreme Court of the United States had no choice. It had to decide all the cases that somebody appealed to them. Justice Marshall, in his famous opinion in Marbury, said, you know, that's why we have to make constitutional laws, because we have to decide these cases. We have no choice about it, and therefore we must decide whether what Congress has done is constitutional.
Right.
So the idea that some lower court judges might be doing some of the selecting and designating some cases that they would have to decide would simply take us back a few decades to a former time. And it would result in requiring the justices to decide a considerably larger number of cases. A few years ago, they were deciding a couple hundred cases a year, and somehow, because of the selection process, we're down to 1 year. Last year, it was down below 70.
Well, we'll have to think of ways of putting them to work. And
okay,
but I don't know that we're going to be able to do it on this program. But at least this idea is worth kicking around. I'm glad we had a chance to do that.
Well, I hope so.
Okay. We have
Thank
to end it
the
there.
Time.
Paul Carrington organized the proposal to limit the terms and powers of Supreme Court justices. He teaches law at Duke University and joined us from a studio on the campus there. Tomorrow, President Obama took office barely a month ago, and already the pundits are calling his term a wild success and a miserable failure. It all depends on who is talking. NPR's Don Gagne will look at what's worked and what hasn't in President Obama's first month. That's all tomorrow. You've been listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Joe Palca.